Well, this evening we continue our series in Job, and Gaz read chapter 38, or the majority of it for us, but tonight we're going to be looking at 38 and 39 together. So after the ramblings of young Elihu, it comes the reply from a sovereign God. Having heard from Job, his three friends, and now Elihu, God is ready to speak. He's finally had enough of their bickering. It's now time to confront them. And he comes to confront them both in his words and in his presence. So look, without delay, let's get straight into our text. The first point this evening is God speaks to Job. Look at verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, but before we look at what the Lord said, first consider where he came from. Look what it says there. The Lord answered Job out of the storm. Well, back in chapter 37, Elihu spoke of this coming storm. He saw the storm ahead. So now, having been absent for the previous 35 chapters, God himself speaks. And significantly, God did not immediately or directly speak to Job's friends. He didn't speak straight to Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, or Elihu. No, God answered Job. And I believe there's two reasons why God answered Job and not the others. Firstly, because Job was the one that was wrongly accused. And then secondly, because Job was the only one of the group to cry out to God. He was the only one to pray through the ordeal. Only Job talked to God. Now the Lord will speak only to Job. He came to settle this dispute, but he's going to do it his way. A reminder of who is in control. You see, Job wanted God to settle the dispute, proving that he was right. Whereas Job's friends, however, they wanted God to prove that they were right. Yet we'll see in the verses ahead, God will not satisfy either of these expectations. So before we look further at our passage, just consider that storm again. Elihu, he saw a storm coming and described it as an example of God's power. But unbeknown to Elihu, in this same storm, God speaks to Job. God arrives in the storm, and which it's not the first time that God has done this. Throughout the Old Testament, there's examples of storms and, well, whirlwinds. Storms and whirlwinds which have marked God's divine presence. These storms show us the powerful and unmanageable nature of God. He is like a storm or a whirlwind that cannot be controlled or opposed. Now, I'm using this term whirlwind here as an equal to a storm, because if you have the ESV, then it translates verse 1 of chapter 38 as the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. And here are some examples that you can find. Other examples. God brought Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind. 2 Kings 2 verses 1 through to 11. God's presence is in the whirlwind in Psalm 77. It's in verse 18. God's coming is like a whirlwind. Isaiah 66 verse 15, I should say. And then God appeared to Ezekiel in a whirlwind in chapter 1, verse 4. But you may also recall back in Job 1, verse 19, that Job's troubles began when a great wind killed his children. The Lord was in that storm, and now he speaks from the storm here in chapter 38. And what is it that he says to Job? Well, God calls Job to account. Look at verses 2 and 3 there. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. There's much debate here as to whom the question in verse 2 is directed towards. Some say it's Elihu because he was the previous speaker and he claimed to speak for God. Yet there is evidence to suggest that the question was directed to them all, to Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu. They all spoke words without knowledge. But there's no doubt in verse 3 that God is warning Job to brace himself. You see, Job had previously complained God was battling against him, Job 16, verses 7 through to 14. Now, God is challenging Job to prepare himself like a man. Because Job had insisted that God brings answers to him. God now, he turns the matter around. He tells Job that before he answers his questions, he's got some of his own first. Job has some questions to answer, which leads us on to our third point this evening. You may think we're racing through these points, but this is the biggest. God questions Job on what he does not know. Look there, that God, he wastes no time in launching into a series of questions. From verse 4, and continuing all the way through chapter 39, God asks more than 40 questions, one after the other, each requiring an answer from Job. But fear not, I've condensed God's questions into a sequence of just 7 for us tonight. Let's look at these together. Look at this first one. Do you know about the foundations of the earth? Look at verses 4 through to 7 with me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Imagine hearing the voice of the Lord ask you, where were you? Sorry to point at you, Rod. Someone else. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Talk about a knockout punch, first question up. But then notice how God simply puts these questions. He uses the basic question words that we perhaps all learnt as children. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ruth, but do it afterwards. He asked Job where, who, what, and when, or while, depending on your translation. But the most significant question is this first one. It's the killer question. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Answer, nowhere. Man was not there. Man was not even in existence yet. Where did the universe come from? Who brought it into being? What process was followed? Now, the whole world debates these questions, but man will never answer them. Man will never be able to answer them because we weren't around to observe. Do you know about the boundaries of the sea? Look at verses 8 through 11. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place. When I said, this far you may come and no further, here is where your proud waves halt. God describes the sea as if it were a child, hence the term from the womb. The emphasis in these verses is on who controls the oceans and the seas. People cannot control the sea, that comes under God's control. God decides the boundaries of the sea. He shuts the sea behind the doors. He tells the seas how far they can come. He halts the waves. We can build the biggest flood defense systems ever. God can send the waves over them. But God will not allow the sea to flood the whole world again. Genesis 9:11 there. Job has no authority over the sea. Man has no authority over the sea. Do you know about the nature of light and darkness? Look at verses 19 through to 24. What is the way to the abode of light, and where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the path to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You've lived so many years. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or seen the storehouses of the hail, which I reserve for times of trouble, for days of war and battle? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed, or the place where the east winds are scattered over the earth? Here we see God asked Job, do you know where light comes from? And it appears that as if God kind of mocks Job by saying, surely you should know. You should know because you've been born already and you've lived many years. Now, Job was old and wise, so perhaps he did know these things. And if this was the case, then God invited Job to speak up and answer at any time. Job remained quiet. He gave no answer at all. Look at verses 22 and 23 there. We hear the mention of snow and hail, wars and battles. Now, on several spectacular occasions in the Bible, God uses hail as missiles. He uses hail as a tool of judgment against God's enemies, as seen against Egypt in Exodus 9:24, as seen against the Canaanites in Joshua 10, verse 11, and as seen against the rebellious earth in Revelation 16, 20 to 21. Again, this shows the power God has over all creation. Do you know about the effects of the weather? Do you know about the nature of the rain and its effects? Look at verses 25 through to 30. Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm to water a land where no man lives, a desert with no one in it, to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass? Does the rain have a father who fathers the drops of dew, from whose womb comes the ice, who gives birth to the frost from the heavens, when the waters become hard as stone, when the surface of the deep is frozen? Now, the weather is another wonderful example of God's greatness. When the rain comes, nobody knows why. Likewise, when the sun shines. Here, God showed Job that man was completely unable to cause the rain. It's only he who controls the weather and uses it for his own purposes. Look there at verse 27. God, he even waters the grass where nobody lives. Man would not choose to water that grass. I don't even water my garden. God controls the whole world. He looks after all the plants and the animals. Do you know about the stars? Look at verses 31 through to 33. Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Now, people have been watching the stars for centuries. The stars have been used like a calendar to mark the different seasons. They've also been used to help travelers work out directions for journeys. Now, Job knew about the patterns of the stars, but he could not explain how God had arranged these patterns. Now, today, due to advances in technology, we know much more about the stars. But despite these advances, there are many millions of stars we cannot see. And each star is powerful, and the distance between each of the stars is incredible. And the Bible tells us that God created the stars. Whilst people have studied them and discovered many things, they are merely discovering things that God has already done. They were merely describing his incredible work. There's nothing new to discover, which God hasn't already discovered. He made the stars, and he also made the skies. And do you know about the skies? Look at verses 30 4 through to 38. Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourselves with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, here we are? Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens when the dust becomes hard and the clogs of earth stick together? Job and his friends had seen a storm, and it impressed them. I don't know about you, but occasionally I look out the window, and when you see the lightning, it is just like, wow. It's slightly scary for some, but it is powerful. The lightning is very powerful. And here, the rain was so heavy that this previously solid ground was now just mud. In Job 26, verse 14, it reads, "Who then can understand the thunder of his power?" Job had likened God's power to like the power of a storm, but God is much more powerful than a storm. In fact, he controls the storm. The rain and the lightning, they answer him. They do not answer Job or us. We and Job are insignificant and powerless. Do you know about the creatures of the earth? Look at verses 39 to 41. We've not looked at these together because Gaz stopped at 38 for me, but read these together. Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in a thicket? Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander around for lack of food? These final three verses in chapter 38, I think, set the scene for what's to come in this next chapter. Until now, much of the theme has been about the heavens and the earth. Now, the emphasis, it shifts towards God's care for his created animals. And in these final three verses, and then into Job 39, God is going to challenge Job on his knowledge of his, that's God's, animals. And in these three verses here, God identifies the difference between lions and ravens. Because lions, you see, they are strong animals, one of the fiercest across the lands. Most of the time they rest, waiting, crouched under the trees and bushes. Ravens, on the other hand, they're large birds. They're noisy, boisterous in their conduct. And you'll notice that there is a distinct difference in their behavior. Look there, lions appear to wait for God to provide their food. Whereas ravens, they do not wait for food to come to them. I guess they're like poor people who wander in search of food. But God provides for ravens as well as lions. He cares for all his creatures. Whether we're like the lion or the raven, whether we're rich or poor, we all depend on God in the same way to supply our food. Nobody cares for the creatures of the earth like God does. So if he cares this much for his creatures, how much more does he care for us? Look, as we move into chapter 39, God continues to question Job on his creatures. Look at verses 1 through to 12. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch where the doe bears her fawn? Do you count the months till they bear? Do you know the time they gave birth? They crouch down and bring forth their young. Their labor pains are ended. Their young thrive and grow strong in the wilds. They leave and do not return. Who let the wild donkeys go free? Who untied his rope? Who gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt flats as his habitat? He laughs at the commotion in the town. He does not hear a driver's shout. He ranges the hills for his pasture and searches for any green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will he stay by your manger at night? Can you hold him to the furrow with a harness? Will he till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on him for his great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to him? Can you trust him to bring in your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? In these opening 12 verses here, we're introduced to three different animals. Look, we're introduced to the mountain goat, the wild donkey, and the wild ox. There's emphasis placed on the words mountain and wild here. These are not tame animals God is describing. They do not obey instructions. These wild animals behave as God intended them to behave. Verse 8, they range the hills for pastures and search for anything green. Wild goats live in the mountains. They're shy and stay far away from people. And a young goat is not loyal in any way. They don't stick with their mothers. As soon as they're old enough, they're off, leaving their mothers behind. Wild donkeys, well, they're the same. They don't care about people's arguments. They're not responsible. They're left to wander for their own food. Sometimes a wild donkey will go hungry. That's in contrast to the tame donkey. A tame donkey is a loyal animal. They're often used, aren't they, to carry heavy loads. They're reliable and trustworthy. But a wild donkey obeys no such orders. All these three animals here mentioned, out of the three of them, the ox is the strongest animal. They're very useful on the farm. Job has 500 of them. We read that in chapter 1, verse 3. But in contrast, a wild ox would not help the farmer either. It might wander into the fields, but it wouldn't obey the farmer. Instead, it would spoil the crops. The farmer could never trust the wild ox. It would take the crops, I'm sure it would, but it'd eat them for themselves, not take them to the stores. The untamable nature of these animals is something only God has given them. Job certainly hasn't. So God rightly questions Job with, "Do you really know about the creatures of the earth?" And the answer is no. So again, Job has to hang his head. He does not really know anything about them. And if we're honest, neither do we. Verses 13 through to 18. The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, but they cannot compare with the pinions and feathers of the storks. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly, as if it were not hers. She cares not that her labor was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider. From the wildness of the ox to the stupidity of the ostrich, God himself takes the blame for the behavior of the ostrich. Surely these are some of the most humorous verses in the Bible. Never would I imagine speaking from the pulpit about ostriches. Now, there's no denying that God has created some strange birds and animals, and the ostrich is certainly in that category. So it's a bird with wings, but it cannot fly. Whereas most birds take excellent care of their eggs, the ostrich is like, nope. Just leaves them on the ground, in the open, to be got. The ostrich, it shows little care for its own young birds. It's clear that God did not teach the ostrich to be wise, but God did teach the ostrich to run, and boy, can it run. An ostrich can outrun a horse. God taught the ostrich to run from danger. It's as if God says, "Oh, I like it that way. I made them that way." That's what God is describing here. These are his animals that he made. If he wants an ostrich to outrun a horse, then that is his choice. Who are we to question what God has created? God then moves on to three further animals in verses 19 through to 30. Do you give the horse its strength or clothe its neck with a flowing mane? Do you make him leap like a locust, striking terror with his proud snorting? He paws fiercely, rejoicing in his strength, and charges into the fray. He laughs at fear afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts, "Aha!" He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread his wings towards the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build his nest on high? He dwells on a cliff and stays there at night. A rocky crag is his stronghold. From there, he seeks out his food. His eyes detect it from afar. His young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there is he. God now describes a horse, firstly, which is in stark contrast to the ostrich. The ostrich is cowardly and runs away from danger, whereas the horse is brave and strong, and nothing frightens them, which I guess is probably why you see horses being rode in battle and not ostriches. The horse has that unique character. They love conflict and competition. They love to race. They love to be out at front. They love to be in the thick of the action. If you ever watch the Grand National, whenever the rider becomes unseated, the horse doesn't stop, does it, and think, "Oh, well, I'm done now." No, they're still in amongst the thicket, aren't they? And they're trying to get to the line first. And it must be so disappointing when they cross the line first, and they're probably thinking, "I was going to do a horse voice then, but I've won the race." And then they're told the medal's awarded to the horse with the jockey on. That's how they were made. They were made to be out in front, in the thick of the action. And who made them that way? That's God's question here. God then concludes by speaking about the hawk and the eagle. And both are majestic birds. And both have similar characteristics. They both soar above everyone else. They both command from on high. Their eyesight is incredible as they detect their prey from afar. I'm hoping that's right because there's some bird lovers sitting down here. Anyway, who gave them these abilities? Who commands the eagle to soar? For a final time, Job again offers no answer. He's silenced by this display of God's creative wisdom. Job recognizes that God is simply out of his league. So if God is Premier League, then Job is nothing but Vauxhall Conference. He's insignificantly small in comparison to God. Yet remember earlier, in Job's speeches, Job wanted to meet God. Job wanted God to act as his judge. He was sure that God would help him and would declare him innocent. And in doing so, Job would be able to approach God like a prince. Job 31, verse 37. But Job thought that God had caused his troubles. He thought that God was a cruel enemy and spoke as much, Job 16, 9 through to 14. He argued that he was right, and he argued that God was unfair, Job 32, verse 2. So as we draw to a close, what can we learn this evening? Well, in God's first response here, he did not explain Job's troubles. Instead, he taught Job. God gave a list of many things that Job could not explain. These things are the work of God. Nobody else could do such things. As God continued to speak, Job came to realize his error. Like last week, again, quoting from Job 42, sorry, Phil, verses 2 and 6 this time. Verse 2, "I know that you can do all things. No plans of yours could be thwarted." And then verse 6, "Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job recognizes, compared with God, that he knows nothing. Zilch. Zippity-bop. Job was speaking about things that he did not know and knew little about. And as a result, it led to his silence. His mouth was closed as he had no answer. And sometimes our troubles bring us to a place when we shut our mouths. We stop complaining. But you know what? That's not what God wants. What he wants is for us to trust him, to put the matter back into his hands and believe he is working things out. In this first response to Job, he discusses many different subjects. He spoke about the foundations of the earth, about the boundaries of the sea, about light and dark, the different weather, the stars and the skies, and now at the end here, many different creatures. And he explained why no man should ever accuse God. Why? Because we've seen throughout the book of Job, God is sovereign. We live in a created world designed by a creator God. He created it all. Now, some may think they are powerful, but they're nothing compared to God. As Rupert Bentley Taylor said yesterday at the men's convention, God is Lord over all and his capacity is limitless. Now that would get an amen from Pastor Phil if he was here tonight, I'm sure. Now you may feel the application this evening is perhaps a little weak, but I really believe the purpose of God's initial response here is to get Job thinking. God doesn't provide Job with an explanation. Instead, he provides Job with some teaching. He's teaching Job that he is sovereign. He is sovereignly in control over everything, even over the ostrich. O Father, you are sovereign in all the worlds you made. Your mighty words have spoken and light and life obeyed. Your voice commands the season and bounds the ocean shore, sets stars within their courses and stills the tempest's roar.